This is episode 20 of Free as in Freedom for Tuesday, January 17th, 2012. Hi, I'm Karen Sandler.
And I'm Bradley Kuhn.
This is Free as in Freedom.
And the fact is that we just released 1F just before we recorded this.
Just minutes.
Yeah. Well, 20 minutes, but...
Oh, okay.
We're recording the day you all heard 1F. Actually, Linux Outlaws has started doing this, where they say what date they're recording, just in case there's confusions about date. And so we're actually recording on...
You mean confusions January. About...
About because if you say things, because the whole podcasting in the past
thing. Because of time travel.
Yeah.
Stephen Colbert made a comment.
Well, yeah, they always could...
I apologize if there was just a buzzing. I was playing with the wire. But I won't do that anymore.
Okay.
So, so there was a joke on Colbert about traveling in time.
Well, because every time there's a major election of any kind or anything, they have to record before it actually has results.
Right.
That was probably what it was about one of the Republican primaries.
If you guys come to New York, you should go to a filming of Colbert.
Yeah, we saw the 100th episode.
Oh, I forgot that it was. Yeah.
It was the 100th episode.
That was really fun.
Well, actually, it was a bad one to have gotten tickets for, other than you'll never forget which episode it was.
Right.
Because he did a lot of clips, remember? And it was all on the monitors.
Yeah.
There was less actual show.
There was a guest, but the guest wasn't too impressive.
Well, the guest for the Daily Show was horrible. Remember, it was one of those comedians who has one of those really bad movies.
Oh, yeah.
That was the horror. That was back when Daily Show was still having. Because Karen and I went to both. We went to Daily Show and we went to Colbert.
With my dad.
Yes, Colbert was with your dad. And Colbert said your dad looked like Ted Turner.
Which he does not.
Well, that was weird. They just have the same mustache. It's the only thing your dad has in common. your dad does have the same mustache as Ted Turner, but otherwise he does not look anything like
My dad thought it was the funniest thing
that
ever happened to him.
Ever happened to him? Ever?
Well, I don't know.
Probably that week.
That week, for sure. He thought it was very funny.
Yeah. So
So we had to record today, which is a Sunday, because I'm heading out on Wednesday for Linux Conf Australia.
And with this, I'm just checking to see if this is going to have the date of your keynote. This will come out. Yeah. And so by your clock, listeners, Karen will be keynoting in 2 days at...
I really want to do like Linux a Wayne's Conf World.
But we're talking about the future now.
I know.
So not the past. So you'll be keynoting at Linux Conf Australia.
Yeah.
On Thursday.
Yeah, and I'm giving another talk actually about nonprofits and organizational issues as well. I forget what I think it's on Tuesday. So I'm actually giving two talks, but
oh, that's good. So you'll have.
I figure once you go all the way.
To Australia.
Yeah. I'm excited about that, though. And also, right before Linux Conf Australia is Ada Camp Melbourne. So I'm really excited that I haven't been to an Ada Camp before.
So is that about Ada Lovelace?
It's a day to gather women in technology. And I think it's sort of an open conference format type thing. So I've never done that. And I'm really excited about it. I've noticed that, you know, as we've sort of gotten more involved in free software conferences and things like that, I've realized that there really is a need to talk about these issues. I remember, you know, when I was younger and, you know, when I came out of engineering school, I used to roll my eyes a little bit about some of the discussion about, you know, we need to make sure that we have women included in this discussion or that discussion. I sort of felt, well, you know, if women wanted to be involved in that discussion, they would be anyway. But I've noticed that as I've become more, gone down the road more in my career, that even, you know, that I'm falling into some of the traps that women often do. So I tend not to submit as many proposals as male counterparts. Sometimes I find that I don't promote myself in the same way. I don't know. This is maybe a stage fright thing, but I freak out every time that I'm going to talk somewhere, have to sort of convince myself that it's worth talking. So it's kind of a funny thing, and I know that a lot of women feel, not all women, you can't generalize, you know, about any of these things because people are individuals. But I find that it is really important to invite women to speak and to identify them as experts, even if you, for example, put out a call for papers and, you know, you get 30 responses, you know, it may still be worth inviting a woman to speak who didn't submit a proposal because women are simply less likely to submit proposals.
Yeah, and you had encouraged us to do that for the FOSDEM track, which I think was very valuable. I think there are a lot of people. I've actually always been for affirmative action myself. It's not as hotly debated as it once was. Affirmative action was heavily debated. I remember when I was in college, there was very aggressive debates in the United States about whether affirmative action was appropriate for all different classes of underrepresented people. My view is that it's got to be correct, mainly because the statistics shouldn't have worked out the way they did, and therefore there's obviously something wrong, right? If you look at the percentage of women in the population, which is actually 51%, as I recall, there's more women
something
in the world
like that.
Right now.
I don't know if that's still true, but
at one point it was 51% women, 49% men in the U.S. and actually worldwide. And then you look at just technology specifically, or free software, pretty much any way you cross cut any science like field. You get these very low percentages of female participation. So there's something obviously wrong, because statistics would say that it would have shaken, if everything was truly equal, it would have shaken out normally, and we'd have 51% women and 49% men, right?
I don't know.
It should have
shaken
out that way.
Actually, it's funny that we mentioned my father before, because I did have this long discussion with him, because he's an engineer, about the representation of women in engineering and at his company. And they, you know, there are certain initiatives that they do to, you know, and this was in the context of working hard on the GNOME Women's Outreach Program, or Outreach Program for Women, you know, that I was talking to him about it, and I was so excited because it has such great results for GNOME. I sort of was shocking to him about maybe implementing something similar for his engineering company. And he sort of started going down the road of saying, well, look, not all women are interested in engineering the same way that all men are. And it was a really fascinating discussion to have with him because, you know, he raised me as a science geek. You know, he always treated me, I mean, I would credit my father for a huge portion of my technical orientation. Like, I mean, I was always interested, but he, you know, he was constantly encouraging me, constantly working with me. And it was so helpful and so wonderful. And so it's funny to hear him sort of say, well, there is a nature aspect to it too, where, you know, just women simply in general are not as interested in these kinds of, you know, these kinds of subject matter. So it's kind of funny because, you know, I think that you can't completely discount that. So when you say something's wrong, I think there maybe is some difference between the sexes. In terms of what people would tend to be interested in. But there are plenty of women who would be interested in sciences, plenty of women who are technology bent. And it's not simply, are we being inclusive? Is there something wrong that's keeping women out of technology? But it's also, who are we identifying as experts? And, you know, because, you know, I think it's just not a straight calculation of percentages in the way that you're describing. But we there are things we can do. Mm-hmm. To improve the situation.
Do you think that women are socialized to be less self-promotional? Because one of the things that's true about free software, actually, and it differs in some way from other technology fields, that you actually have to be very self-promotional. Things like shepherding patches and other types of things you have to do. You have to get on mailing lists and advocate for your direction for mm-hmm. a project. And you don't need to do that as much. Frankly, in proprietary software, you don't need to do that as much because you have managers telling you what to do. And so if you just, you can basically be a valuable person in a proprietary software project by basically doing what you're told in some sense. Mm-hmm. And in free software, doing what you're told is kind of the opposite of what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to do what you think is right. And do you think that women are socialized to not be as aggressive in their advocating for their own work? And could that be a reason?
That's interesting. I mean, you raise it and you ask me what I think, and I think I'm entirely unqualified to answer that question. Mm-hmm. Like, that is a really
complex. Well, you're obviously not socialized for that because you just explained that your father helped you not be socialized that way. And
well,
therefore,
that's only one piece of the story, right? I mean, there's all of the social cues that one picks up when one's, you know, when I was a little girl, I wasn't, you know, it wasn't in a world that was completely controlled by one person or by two people. Both my parents were very, very encouraging of me. And, you know, but there are all these...
If you have your parents to back... If your parents are backing you up, it's actually... With really good parents, I think it's very easy to fight the world in some sense. Because your parent, even if the world is telling you a different thing, your parents are back you up.
But it's more subtle than that. It's a lot more subtle than that. Like, there are all these... You know, and it's funny because there's all this conversation about this recently because there was a New York Times article that points to this this YouTube video of this little girl in a toy store. And she's sort of... Her father's videotaping her. And she's in this, like, this whole row of toys. And she says, but I don't understand why do girls have to have pink things. Like, why? And why do boys have to have other colored things? And I don't understand. I mean, it's just amazing. And it's just really, really poignant. And she's, you know, I mean, to some extent, it's clear that they've had this conversation in their family. And she's, you know, she's picked up on what's going on. But at the same time, it's really, you can just feel her frustration. And it's not coming from, you know, from her parents per se. You know, is she, this is a little girl in a toy store saying, well, you know, little girls like, you know, girls like princesses and superheroes. Like, why do we only have to have pink things? And it, I don't know. So, I mean, it just, there are all these messages and social cues that you pick up just by being alive, by watching television, by getting the toys that you get, by, you know, how people react to you in school. And all these things make very powerful.
And I agree with you that these these things are socialized, and that's going back to affirmative action. That's why I'm for affirmative action, because there's this concerted socialization effort that's a problem, and therefore we need affirmative action to help basically offset that. So I'm for that, and I agree with you. I guess my question is basically, what's the difficulty in trying to overcome that once it's known?
What do you mean?
For example. So obviously you're the executive director of a technology related nonprofit. So you're actively overcoming this on a daily basis, but is that a constant difficulty that you face?
Or
is
No. I mean, well, also the GNOME community is so awesome that I don't feel the obstacles that traditionally people might feel in that community. And so that's pretty great. I mean, but on the other hand, I would say that I highly doubt that I would have become a regular speaker at conferences if it hadn't been for affirmative action. And nobody's told me, incidentally, that I was chosen or invited or anything like that because I'm a woman. But, you know, sometimes my talks are accepted or I'm invited when I know really good talks, people who are awesome, are not accepted. And, you know, I know that sometimes that probably has something to do with the fact that I'm a woman. And, you know, and that has had a good effect in the end, truthfully, because now I've had a lot of experience speaking at conferences. I don't think I would have had been able to have done my medical devices talk if it hadn't been for all that lead up, you know, where I got all that basically that courage from having had all those, you know, successful speeches before. You know, I fall into the same traps that many women do, in that I probably A, wouldn't have submitted, and B, would have downplayed my submission, thinking, oh, well, you know, I'm not sure that anyone would have selected my proposal for it.
Well, fear of public speaking is actually pretty universal. It's cross gender lines and cross racial lines and so forth. I remember seeing a thing about stress, and followed this CEO of some company around, and the only time when he had extremely high levels of stress was the 3 minutes before he had to speak that day in front of a party of his staff, and everything else was, he had did all these other things that were, on their surface, would seem much more stressful because he was speaking in front of like 30 people, but that was the highest stress
That's
moment.
Funny.
So I think that the public speaking thing, I think there's fears, but do you think that basically it's worse for women as far as that goes, as far as the public speaking fear, does it sort of, I guess, intersect with these other issues such that it just makes it that much worse?
I think it really does intersect with these other issues. But I would say with me, what's interesting is that I have no problem being in front of crowds. I'm really, really comfortable being in front of crowds. I have, you know, I get really nervous when I'm holding myself out as an expert.
But I've always thought that was, for you personally, that was from your legal training, that lawyers are sort of trained to not opine in a public fashion on something.
I don't know. I think that really dovetails nicely with my, it was a good thing to hide behind too. And, you know, and I think it really, you know, there is something to that as well, But you know, when I was in college, I did a lot of theater. I directed plays and did welcome people to shows, you know, where there was a packed audience, and never was I that nervous for those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. But when I try to hold myself out as an expert on anything, even if it's not necessarily a legal thing, I'm really nervous, and I'm much less likely to suggest that opportunity arise in the first place. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is funny, because that's what I've been doing a lot of for the last couple of years.
Yeah, although I think it was a long time before I felt that I could safely consider myself an expert on things. I probably, even to this day, I basically consider myself an expert on nonprofit issues in free software, on free software licensing, and specifically GPL enforcement. And those are probably the only topics that I truly feel comfortable considering myself an expert on. There's lots of things in free software that I'm constantly afraid of being considered an expert on, because I'm not as good a developer as a lot of other developers, and there's all these other things that I feel very not confident about, that I often am in a situation where I have to hold myself as an expert on. And it's nerve-wracking.
I
think it's true for everybody.
Yeah, these issues, they're complicated, and part of why they're complicated is because they cross gender lines. And when we talk about this stuff, it's mostly like, women are more likely or less likely, or, you know, and, you know, people are individuals. But I guess the truth is that when you come down to it, if you don't go out of your way to try to get women to be present at conferences to speak, and to be identified as experts, for their writings to be included with public, you know, with work that is having, you know, attention pointed at it, then, you know, we just get into this terrible situation where women will never most likely be included. So I don't know. I think I probably would have said, if someone had asked me, you know, a few years ago, would you want to be invited to a conference if you knew that you were being invited because in part because you were a woman, I probably would have said, no way. No desire to be part of that. Mm-hmm. And now I sort of see that it really was happening, and, you know, and I gave some good talks, I think, which I wouldn't have been able to have done otherwise. And, you know,
Well, I always thought this was the last time I heavily debated affirmative action with people was in college when Clarence Thomas was being elected to, or being, I'm sorry, being confirmed to the Supreme Court. And a philosophy professor I had in college made an interesting point, which is Clarence Thomas is against affirmative action, but the fact that he's being put on the Supreme Court is a result of affirmative action, effectively. And so it's just an interesting point that you can be against affirmative action and also be a beneficiary of it to mm-hmm. some extent. It sounds like you're now both for it and okay with being a beneficiary of it.
I think so, because I've seen the benefits a lot more, and I, now that I'm much more entrenched in the free software world, now that I'm much more involved in the free software world and been more, you know, spent a lot of time here, I see how few women there really are, and how these outreach programs like the GNOME Women's Outreach Program make such a big difference and get people excited and.
Well, I'm completely for affirmative action in the free software world, but both for gender equality and for racial and other types of diversity. I mean, we're not even racially diverse either as a community, and so we need both types of affirmative action in free software. And I don't really know how we promote it more easily. I mean, I think the programs that GNOME Foundation is doing, the outreach program, is useful in particular because it's reaching out to people who are in school, younger people who are still students.
Although there really is a wide age range, which is
cool. Yeah, I understand that, but I think that it seemed
and there's also some racial diversity too, which is great.
Yeah, I agree with that too. And I've heard some interviews on this. There was stuff on NPR about general issues of technology. Gender affirmative action in technology, and proprietary software companies are actually very good at this. I heard this interview with a woman who went to work for Microsoft in part because of the programs Microsoft had internally for affirmative action for gender for women engineers and women developers. And so, in some sense, from a purely almost mercenary point of view, if proprietary software companies are doing this, proprietary software companies are wooing women in technology away on this issue, that's a way that they can defeat free software in some sense, right? Because if proprietary software companies get this, and the people like Adobe, like Microsoft, are building these kinds of affirmative action programs and are better at it, which they probably are right now, it basically means we have a less diverse community, and a less diverse community means free software's not going to be as good.
Yeah.
Frankly, I mean, it's just true.
I think so too. But I mean, but you've also put your finger on another point with why we have fewer women too. I mean, you know, that it's also in part because there are so few women and minorities less of them in software generally. They get hired, they get snapped up by proprietary software companies sometimes, you know, at the very beginnings of their academic careers.
Yeah.
I would never forget the career fair, the first career fair I went to as a first year in college, mm-hmm. in engineering school, and just the interest I got from, you know, I didn't know anything. I was a, you know, 18-year-old, you know, engineering, first year engineering student, didn't know a thing, and there were companies that were almost willing to hire me right then and there.
I've always wanted to ask you this, so I'll ask you it on the air to make it a real action. So do you think that you went to law school because you felt there was more gender diversity and it was less of a uphill battle in the legal profession as opposed to
definitely staying in not engineering? Definitely not. I went to.
So why the hell did you go to law school then?
I really have a. It's so funny when I talk to people who are, you know, law students who come to me for guidance or who are interested in technology or free software, and say, you know, I just had somebody call me and say, I want your career path. I want to do what you did. How do I do it? And I sort of say. And, you know, this guy was just starting out law school, sort of like, wow, you are so far beyond where I was. I went to law school because I didn't really want to be an engineer. And I went to engineering school and I really didn't know what I wanted to do. And nobody at the Cooper Union really went to law school. It was kind of like this different, quirky, unknown thing to do. So I just decided, hey, I want to go to law school. And then when I went to law school, I couldn't believe that there were so many women there. I didn't even think about the issue. And I was sitting in class and I was like, whoa, this is different.
Yeah, because it's pretty, the law profession's pretty, I mean, if you want to talk about actually equal gender, it seems to me it's pretty equal.
Oh, it's equal in law school. In law school, there are more women than men. When you graduate at law firms, it then is like roughly equal. But every year in the profession, the number of women drops off very, very steeply. And if you look at the...
Well, law firms plus are such, basically, if you take time off at all, like if you want to have a family, then you sort of get screwed in law firms.
It's getting better. But yeah, I mean, and if you look at law firm partners, for example, there are very few. I mean, the percentage is completely skewed the other way.
Well, that's true in computer science academics as well. The ACM did a survey recently, and it's that same thing where you look at associate professors and there's plenty of gender diversity. And then each tier you go up to full professor, going up to dean, going up to other levels of academic success, that's where the numbers start to look bad. Because you look at it, you go to the associate professor, you go to grad school in computer science, associate professor line in computer science, it's totally gender equal. Like it's straight up 50-50 type arrangement. Right. And then as you go up the chain, that's where it really, the glass ceiling really starts to come into
play. It's amazing. And you know, when I was at the law firm, it was fascinating because it was even more pronounced overseas, which is where I was practicing cross-border securities law. And we would go into these conference rooms and we would be doing these deals. And then the room would split and like you'd get senior lawyers and management together to talk about some of the more important issues. And then the junior lawyers would all go into the document room and be reviewing the documents. And it would basically be like when you had that split, all of the women would go out to the document review room and all the men would stay because all the management and the, you know, there were exceptions, but most of the management and the senior lawyers, the partners were all men. And so it was like the women went off to their their menial work and the men stayed to talk about the, you know, the big issues. I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of law firms are doing stuff to try to help change that. But we've got powerful societal issues at work. And as I said at the beginning, like it's the old, if you're a woman in free software, you're asked to be an expert on women about free software.
Yeah.
And
well, that's what Selena Deckelman always complains about.
Yeah. And, Alex, Kirliska.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Also always says the same thing. So, Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's tough. So I don't. I'm no expert. I've read, you know, some articles and you know, that refer to various studies of various sorts. But I don't, you know, I don't have a degree in this stuff, and I'm not an expert in it.
Yeah,
it just fascinates me, and I see anecdotally what effects it has.
Yeah, I mean, basically, the way I've always viewed this is I came to the conclusion when I was in college that obviously everything had to have been very easy for me because I was white and male. And I just concluded that because I had so many people that I would interact with that were reporting things were more difficult. And it's one of these things, it's actually very similar to, why would anybody choose to be gay kind of thing? Because like, it's so difficult to be gay in our society. So obviously they can't be choosing to be gay. And it's the same sort of thing. It's like why would people just complain for no good reason in some sense of like, oh, it's so difficult. I have trouble, getting interviews, whatever.
Right.
Like why would people just make all that up?
Oh, I mean, I can point
and that's what I came to the conclusion. It was like, it's either there's a broad conspiracy of people who are not white men saying that it's difficult for them, like a widespread worldwide conspiracy, or it must be true. There's only those two things that are true. It's obviously not a conspiracy, so it must be true.
I had like completely supportive parents, and you know, as I said, that wasn't an issue when I was, you know, in my home. But I had a calculus teacher tell me that only girls could do math, you know, and that I shouldn't bother.
That only girls
could not that
do
only
math.
But that only only I'm sorry only. Sorry, that only boys were good
okay,
at math.
Okay, I said that backwards.
Sorry about that. I totally said that backwards. But like, you know, where that I shouldn't really bother, basically. And so, you know, it made me feel like, oh, I really need, you know, I'm going to get a 5 on that, you know, on that AP exam. Because just to show you, I'll be the only one in your class and all your, you know, all the boys that you think are going to do something.
Did you get a 5?
Yeah.
Do you own AB or BC? Or did you take both?
I took AB because we just didn't cover the material for BC.
Yeah, I took it 2 years. So I took AB and then I could have taken the BC exam, but weirdly the undergraduate institution I went to, it gave you full credit. They treated the AB and the BC exam as basically the same. It was weird.
Oh.
So that it was is very, weird. Very, it was very weird, but I was like, really? And so I just didn't take the BC. I didn't want to pay for it. So I didn't sit for the BC exam.
We just didn't have the, curriculum in our calculus class.
Oh, that BC. Sucks. Yeah. I took geometry over the summer, my sophomore year of high school, so that I could be sure I took BC, which I ended up not needing, which was pretty funny. And then I took Calc 3 as an elective, which was strange. I don't know why I did that. Huh. I just felt like I should like take some college calculus, so I took Calc 3 as an elective.
Cooper,
you probably had to.
At Cooper, you can't place out of any calculus anyway.
Yeah, well, you probably had to take Calc 3 anyway as a requirement at a place like Cooper.
Oh, loads of math. Well beyond. I mean, they didn't call it. There were only 2 calc classes, but they covered 3, what are 3 semesters elsewhere.
So
but
you did polar coordinates and everything?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah,
I barely remember what I did, but...
That was
a long time ago.
The main topic points I remember being in Calc 3 were double integrals over different coordinate systems and then polar coordinates, which is why you end up doing double integrals over different coordinate systems.
Right, right.
Which I guess you need, somebody needs... I never needed it, but I presume engineers need that.
Engineers need that. I don't remember like so much. I was going through my parents' house to clean out some stuff the other day, and I found all these like notebooks and test exams that from college, and I could see it was like in my handwriting. It was like, I don't know, like literally like a different person wrote this because I can't remember a thing. I can't.
Yeah, the notes,
I didn't even understand the language, you know.
The notes I really wish I knew where they were are from my graduate level theory of computation class. That was the theory I really wish that I could always do because I think theory of computation is really important. But that's a great
I started thing. To I started to relearn calculus because I feel like it was such a big part of how I thought and what I did that, you know, the idea that I can't remember.
Stand and Deliver was on TV last night.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay.
it's the only Hollywood movie about calculus.
Is that true?
I'm pretty sure. Can you name another? Listeners, write in.
I'm not good at movies.
Write in if you know of another Hollywood-produced movie about calculus other than Stand and Deliver. I defy anyone.
When you say Stand and Deliver, I just think of the Adam and the Ant song.
Oh. No, I'm talking about, like, I'm talking about the Edward James Olmos playing the professor.
Right. I remember the movie. Yeah. roughly.
With Lou Diamond Phillips strangely playing. I forgot that it was Here, talk about it, like weird, weird racial things. Lou Diamond Phillips playing a Latino when he's actually Native American. That's weird. Mm. But I guess, as Hollywood thinks, all races can be, anybody who's not white can just be interchanged and it all works somehow. But yeah, so. But
I bet there's another movie about calculus.
I defy anyone to tell me. Okay, so I want to say that, because there's probably some independent film about
calculus. Are we gonna bet?
I'll bet, yeah.
How much do you want to bet? And when I say about calculus, I'm just going to say features prominently.
Features prominently is fine. It has to be, it can't just be some random independent film. It had to be something that had like a wide release, like a major film, like a major film. We'll negotiate about whether something counts as a major film, but I think.
What about, so I have one maybe, but what about like Good Will Hunting?
But he wasn't, he wasn't doing, there was no calculus in that movie.
There was no calculus in that movie?
There was no calculus in that movie.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it was math. It was about math. I agree. If I had said math, you'd have me. But we said calculus. Calculus specifically. I defy you to go through Good Will Hunting and find anything that's calculus in that movie.
Oh, really? I just don't remember what it was about.
Well, cause it's supposed to be all advanced math. I mean, maybe it's really simple math because what they put on the boards. Actually, I was watching, I'm really off topic now, but I was watching the show they have on CNBC or something called American Greed. And it was about, because it was about some person who ran one of these carding forms for credit cards and was breaking into machines, stealing credit card numbers. And every time they showed like he broke into the computer and stuff, it was an output from what looked like rsync building symlinks in Debian. Because my wife was like, she's like, I just saw the word Debian go by. I was like, yeah. I was like that, and I slowed it down. It looked like output from rsync. Then later on, it was clearly, get this, it was probably a LGPL violation. It was clearly the Python bindings for dbus. Because it was clearly stuff written in C to be Python code, like code that hooks up to a Python API in C. But I slowed it down and looked at it, and it was symbols for dbus. Like I saw dbus this, that, and the other thing.
Said just because they figured nobody.
Well, my wife theorized that they just basically had somebody who knew something about computers on the staff say, make some output on a green, you know, it's the usual green screen, like terminal output. Make something that looks, make stuff scroll. Well, they had two versions of, because they could be using the same thing. They must have said, make something that scrolls by, which is what he used that rsync making symlinks output for, because that scrolls. And then they said, make it look like code. And he just grabbed Python, the Python bindings for dbus, which I was pointing out is probably an LGPL violation because I got no source or offer, and it was distributed to me as video, and therefore it was an LGPL violation because that's not a preferred form for modification. The screen output is not a preferred form for modification.
Have you seen Antitrust?
No, but that, you know, that... Isn't that the one that Miguel de Acosta had a cameo in?
Did he?
Or no, was it a different
movie? I never
heard
about Antitrust until a couple of days ago.
Miguel de Acosta had a cameo in one of those movies like that. It might not have been Antitrust. I'm not sure.
Wow.
Yeah, you didn't know that?
No.
Yeah, so now I will.
You act as if I would know that.
Well, but Miguel used to run the organization. You now are the executive director. A long time ago, of course, but.
But how would I know that he had a cameo in?
Because it was all over the GNOME community. I'm teaching you GNOME history in real time.
A long time ago.
It was a long time ago. It was a big deal in the GNOME community in like 2000. See, now I'm trying to get up a web browser and look for Miguel de Acosta.
I was a securities lawyer then.
You probably were. Miguel de Acosta, antitrust. Is that true? Yes, here it is.
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
Now I really want to watch it.
De Acosta has cameo appearances in 2001 in Antitrust and The Code.
What's The Code?
I don't know. We're pulling up the Wikipedia entry now. The Code is a Finnish-made documentary. Oh, it's a documentary. So that's...
Oh, okay.
That doesn't count. Yeah. That has like Eric Allman and Alan Cox.
He has a cameo in Antitrust. Now I really want to watch. Actually, Mike was a big... Or like thinks that movie Antitrust is hilarious, which is how I wound up.
Well, I think it can't hold a candle to Pirates of Silicon Valley, which is the truth. We talked about that one,
which I never saw before our discussion.
That was a made-for-TV.
But I loved it.
Did you actually watch it in the end?
No, I just watched
just
a portion of it.
The one scene that we used that quote from in the previous episode. But
I should watch it.
It was a funny... The Pirates of Silicon Valley is
But awesome. Antitrust looks ridiculous.
Yeah, I think parts of Silicon Valley was more ridiculous.
More ridiculous than
Antitrust? I think so. I've never seen Antitrust all the way through, but I think speed through to find Miguel's scene in 2001.
The whole murder component.
Miguel was super famous. I guess most people don't know this now because Miguel is just yet another free software celebrity like the rest of us.
Famous fickle, but
Miguel was huge. Miguel was probably the most famous free software, later more open sourcey person.
More famous than Richard Stallman?
Miguel was more famous than Richard Stallman
for a while, like
a year and a half. Or,
wow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They never asked Richard Stallman to be in a cameo in a movie.
Well,
he would probably
have said... There may be many reasons for that.
Well, Richard probably would have said no. That's the other thing. Maybe RMS was asked at some point and said no.
Yeah.
But I don't think... I think he would have mentioned if he had been asked. I think I would know that. But no, I don't think he has been. But Miguel was asked to be as a cameo. So, I mean, Miguel was famous, but
I didn't know that he was...
He was a big, famous
movie cameo famous. That's awesome.
He was famous.
That's awesome. That's, like, the best kind of awesome.
He was a kind of a crossover technology. I mean, there was a point there where Miguel was sort of almost a crossover technology, like, general technology celebrity.
Cool.
So, but that was... It was brief. Famous Fickle, as you say. It was very brief.
Famous Fickle.
I learned that the hard way, too. Everybody does. I used to be more famous, and now I'm less famous, which is fine. I got used to it.
It's, you know, it's kind of nice.
Yeah. Well, I was more famous because I was executive director of FSF.
Right.
I mean, basically, I didn't realize that, I mean, I was a little, somewhat egotistical, that I didn't realize that I was famous because I was executive director of FSF. And when I stopped being executive director of FSF, I stopped being famous, which is fine.
You didn't stop being famous.
I was a lot less famous. I was a lot more famous when I was executive director of FSF. Because it was really, you're really living off RMS's fame in some sense.
Right.
Because RMS is the founder of FSF, and then you're the executive director of the organization that Stallman founded. And
right.
So, which is fine. I don't mind not being as famous. I'm happy being on my, just struggling to stay on the B-list, you know?
Yeah.
B-list free software celebrity, that's good for me. As long as I don't drop to the C-list, that's when I get sad. When I feel like I'm heading to the C-list.
I think I'm still sometimes on the C-list.
Oh, you're on the B-list,
but
now, for sure.
I'm solidly on B.
You're solidly
It helps
on the
that I'm a woman.
You have to work to stay on the B-list, though. It could. I mean, it may. I don't know. Yeah. But yeah, I'm not an A-list celebrity. That's definitely true.
I'm very occasionally an A-list celebrity, but not really. I'm like, more like an A-minus.
You'll be an A-list celebrity soon.
But
But everybody on the internet's famous to 15. All three of our listeners, we're A-list to them. I'm sure we're A-list.
The truth is that it really doesn't matter. The truth is that you keep working on things that are meaningful and that you have messages that need to be conveyed and that you convey them.
Yeah, I think that's true. It's true. The thing is that the fame makes it helpful. You get opportunities.
You're occasionally an A as well.
Are you saying just by the fact that I get a keynote once in a while at some
office? Yeah.
Yeah, but I've never been asked to keynote OzCon like you. You're a big, famous OzCon keynoter.
It's funny pairing this all with our affirmative action talk because I'm not going to say anything. but yeah.
I've never been asked to keynote OzCon. I think that's probably... Yeah, to be on the A-list, you have to have been... I think certainly you have to have at least keynoted OzCon one time. Even RMS got to keynote OzCon, and
it's OzCon.
He hates OzCon.
Yeah, there is that, but
Of course, Craig Mundy's also.
I'm pretty sure you're still more famous than me. So,
am I more famous than Craig Mundy? People don't even remember who Craig Mundy is. Now he's just some like random muckety muck at Microsoft. But at the time, he was infamous.
I mean, there are loads of people who have keynoted at OzCon who are less famous than you.
Nah, that can't be true.
It's got to be true.
Because they
also pack in the keynotes.
That's true. They invented the 10-minute keynote.
Yeah.
Which what I hate about the 10-minute keynote is not that it's 10. I actually think their idea of the 10-minute keynote is a good idea. What I hate about the 10-minute keynote is when, and I won't say by name, keynoters have done this, you know who you are, they use it to pitch a talk later. They try to basically make you come to their later talk, which I've seen two particular keynoters who basically their entire talk was a pitch for that, and I really bothered
them. We've seen many more than two.
But I'm thinking of two.
I've never been given two talks, given the chance to give the same talk twice, or, you know, a short version and a long version in a single conference.
Yeah, but I think you used the 10-minute keynote format very well.
Well, mine was 15 minutes.
15, well, 10, 15.
But
You did really good with that format.
Thanks.
It's really
a hard
format. Well, yeah, but I think actually it's hard, but it's it it forces you to a certain type of concision that allows you to deliver one very important message very well, which I think you did.
Well, this is why I think that the 10 to 15 minute keynotes are a good idea, and that it really keeps the discussion very high level and very point focused. So there are a lot more interesting things going on.
The only reason OSCON can do that is because it's so heavily staffed, in the sense that they can, like you were saying, how they have the slide, you can see your own slides and
oh yeah,
all, they have that all set up in the right way. You could not do that. Like say like I keynote at Indiana Linux Fest last year, and there was no way, because they were, it's a community event, and they don't have the kind of, they couldn't hire a tech team to like set up all the stuff.
And you know, when I did when I did Ignite NYC for the first time a few years ago, that was the first time I started talking about the medical devices. They just had the screen off to the side so that I was looking at the slides as they came up. I couldn't see the next slide. Which actually, I don't think I couldn't see that either at OSCON, I don't think.
Well, but Ignite's a special case, I think, because it's a single event designed for talks of that ilk. In a normal conference where most of your talks are going to be the 30-minute, 45-minute style, and then you have to have use the same for keynote, and you have to maybe convert room, which OSCON does in like seconds. It's they get a venue staff that can convert the room.
It's an impressive operation.
Yeah, but that's part of the reason why OSCON's so freaking expensive. It's just basically priced out all community people at this point. What's it, $1,400 to go to OSCON now, or some crazy amount like that?
Yeah, it's really expensive.
I mean, I know I only go because I'm speaking. I mean, basically, I speak at OSCON. I guess they're going to hear this now and they look at my talk and not accept it. But I speak at OSCON basically to go to OSCON, because if I can't speak at OSCON, I can't go.
It's the same thing for me. I need to submit my proposal. Because the deadline's coming.
Yeah, and that's another thing that annoys me about
that the deadline's so early.
The deadline's so early, and they don't let you know early.
Well, it's tough because I need to plan. I don't even know, and I don't need to plan because I'm so last minute. But I can't. I don't know what I really want to talk about then. Like it's 6 months away.
Yeah.
How do I know what the right thing to talk about is going to be?
Yeah.
It's so early.
Yeah. So. I mean, the thing is that if you're going to do that early, why not be a refereed paper conference? Because at that point, you might as well write a paper. You know, because that's the big, like, I don't know if people know this, but there was a big divide at one point, and it's sort of why Usenix is not the forum for free software talks anymore, because there's this, you have to write a paper, it has to be the academic style, and that's why Usenix stopped basically running free software-y kind of stuff, because free software people didn't want to write papers.
Right.
And so that's sort of what opened up the realm for O'Reilly to do OSCON, first Pearl Conference, then OSCON. And the funny thing is now you have to submit to OSCON so early, you might as well be a paper-based refereed system.
It's so, so funny. We have so many conferences in the free software world. We've got
community events better. Yeah. I swear, these community events, like going to Scale and going to those type of weekend events, you have to give up a weekend for them, which is tough for those of us who do this professionally, but I still do it because they're such better events than...
Well, I'm excited for FOSDEM too. Like, I think that's going to
be FOSDEM really is sort of the model of the weekend...
Yeah.
Free software volunteer run event.
I wish it were a little longer. I wish there were one day maybe additional, because there's just so many things going on at once that I want to go to.
But that's the whole thing, is that it's that type of event.
That if any of our listeners are going to FOSDEM and are interested in participating in GNOME marketing, which is the kind of thing that is really great if you're trying to figure out how to get involved in a project without developing. I mean, basically without writing code. It's a really great way to do it. We're going to have like a little mini marketing meeting at FOSDEM. We've got so much going on. So.
Yeah. And so sum up, if you're in Australia, you need to get to LinuxConf Australia to see Karen Keynote in a couple of days as the time you're hearing this. About 5 days later, if you're in the Southern California area, you should come to see me speak. And also, I forgot to mention, I'm doing a BAF. They sort of could not on
Big Bugs.
I'm not doing a what did I say it was last week? Last episode.
Bugs of a feather.
Bugs of an exoskeleton. Session on bed bugs, but they did ask me to do a birds of a feather session on fundraising and nonprofits project. So I'm going to do that, as well as doing a talk on GPL enforcement. I'm probably going to be retiring 12 years of, actually it's 13 years now anyway, but it was still called 12 years when I submitted it, my history of compliance. This Scale will probably be my last, I'm going to retire that talk.
The last on the tour?
Yeah, I mean, I've been giving that talk for a year and a half now, so I need to.
There's only like one talk I've given more than once.
I reuse talks for a while, but that's gonna be my last time giving that talk. I'm working on a new compliance related talk. It's still gonna be compliance related, but I'm actually working on a talk about embedded compliance and how to do embedded compliance.
So there's such a need for that.
Yeah, so I'm moving to that. So that'll be I'm actually gonna be in February. I'm gonna be at the Embedded Linux Conference in San Francisco. Which is the I'm sliding back to look at calendar, and it is the week of the 13th of February, I believe. So I'll be at that.
And then we're almost in March, and I'm going to be speaking at South by Southwest.
Oh, really?
The music festival, actually, the conference. That's pretty excited about.
See, that means you're giving your stuff away for free. Solidly B-list, maybe even A-list.
Well, I'm on a panel.
Okay.
A.
Okay, and you're B-list.
B, but I'm pretty excited because it's South by Southwest music, and there's so much. There's so much turmoil in the music business, and I think there's a real interest now in musicians to figure out how to release their stuff for free and what the implications of that are. So to
run down again, Australians, see Karen soon, LinuxConf Australia. Southern Californians, see me at Scale. Northern Californians, see me at Embedded Linux Conf thereafter. Oh, I'm sorry, before that, see me and Karen if you're European at FOSDEM, then see me at Embedded Linux Conf, then see Karen at South by Southwest, then see me at Libra Planet in Boston if you're in the Northeast.
We can keep going with this.
I think that gets us through March. So we'll remind you about these other ones next time, at least the ones that have not happened yet. But Linux Conf Australia and Scale are the two coming up soon, so see those.
Excellent.
Okay.
Free as in Freedom is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. Free as in Freedom is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 United States license. Please send any feedback to oggcast at faif.us and subscribe to the RSS feed on faif.us.